Howdy and welcome to River Talk, a podcast hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weiseth. Priscilla is out doing Priscilla things this week, working hard and changing the world.
She is so, working hard.
Yeah, I mean, all those things are true, I'm sure. Yeah. So we have a guest with us today, Aaron Cavagnolo. I probably butchered that, but, you know, is what it is. And this week, a big thing we're going to talk about is how to become a river guide. Change your life for the better. This is your year. But before that, news of the week. So, Zach, Aaron, and Aaron, feel free to correct me in your name pronunciation.
You nailed it.
You have any news of the week? Wow. Thanks. News of the week.
I'll get started. The big news is the Oregon Wildlands Act, as part of a bigger public lands package, passed the Senate. And that was probably the biggest hurdle was the Senate. It'll almost definitely pass the House, and I'm sure Trump will sign it. But just getting it to a vote was a huge challenge. And then once it got to a vote, it passed 92-8. And here in Oregon, it protects a ton of new rivers as wild and scenic. It adds a wilderness designation in Devil's Staircase. It renames Squaw Creek, Whiteches Creek. It does a bunch of stuff. We've talked about it before. But a really big deal. These kind of public lands packages are kind of once every 5 or 10 years. And it's pretty exciting for us here in Oregon. It does do some stuff that's not awesome in other states. So Alaska kind of gets hammered a little bit. And some public lands turn into private lands. But for those of us that love Oregon rivers, it's a huge win.
So, Zach, how many rivers did that add to your list?
That's the funny part, is it adds 10.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And are they local or are they all over the state? How's that looking?
They're not local. So for those who don't know, I'm trying to run all 58 of Oregon's wild and scenic rivers. Or not. You can't run them all. A lot of them you have to hike along or just visit because they're not paddleable. So I'm at 45 of the 58, and this puts the list at 68. And, they're not close. They're not easy. Some of them I've never heard of, or I know very little about. So I'm about to do some research. But, like, one of them is the Malala, which I've just been meaning to go to for a long time. So, yeah, no, it puts that project – it makes it more difficult.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Yeah. One interesting thing is it adds, I think, 120 miles of tributaries to the Rogue as wild and scenic, which is great news for the fish that depend on that cold water and for us that float the Rogue that don't want to look at clear cuts as we're floating down the Rogue. So that's pretty exciting. But they're not new designations. They're adding them to the current Rogue designation. So they're not technically new wild and scenic rivers. They're part of the Rogue Wild and Scenic package.
Yeah, it's great news for those of us that love the canyon and spend a lot of time down there. And I know there's a lot of people who've been working on this for a long time.
Yeah.
And are really excited. So yep. That's great.
Zach, could you explain the whole thing you said about the clear cutting? I thought the corridor wasn't that far on each side of the river, on each side of the wild scenic rivers.
Yeah, it's only a quarter mile typically. It can differ from a quarter mile, but it's typically. And they can still clear cut in there. So, I mean, the original bill had wilderness protection as well as a national recreation area layer on top of it. And that got stripped out about a month ago partially because there were fires down there and people are worried that wilderness makes it harder to fight fires, which is a somewhat valid complaint, although it's not really that accurate. So the wilderness part got stripped out. That would have stopped the logging. The wild and scenic protection, it protects a quarter mile. So you could log the area still, but it just makes it harder. All these tributaries put up little roadblocks to hopefully slow down logging. And Wyden Senator Wyden in Oregon gave this amazing 26-minute speech on the floor of the Senate talking about our wildlands. He said in that speech, he's like, we're going to finish the protections of the Rogue next. Once this bill passes, he's focused on that wilderness next.
Oh, neat.
Yep. So it's not, we're not giving up.
That's great. Very good. Any other news of the week, Zach?
Yeah, I mean, the Boat Smith is happening. People are headed down there as we speak to go paddle the Smith River in California. Aaron and I have spent many a President's Day weekend together freezing on the Smith River, either high water, low water, or regular water. And it's a great place to paddle. So it's become a huge event. People are coming from all over the West for this event. the water's high. I don't know if you've checked the flows, but it's high water on the Smith. So I hope that everybody heading down there is safe and make smart decisions. It's not a good rafting level for the North Fork of the Smith, unless you don't mind flipping and swimming a long way. Or if you're really good, I guess. But, I mean, still, man, it's big.
Yeah, it's water's supposed to be going up kind of all down in that neck of the woods. So yeah. Could be an exciting weekend.
Yeah, well, for sure. Yeah, I mean, hopefully, I mean, the Smith is an interesting drainage. It spikes up and down, and these runs are very different based on these levels. But there's, you know, 300 miles of river there that's all pretty local. You know, it's like I think of the Smith like an oak tree. It has a short main stem and just a ton of branches coming off of it. So, you know, from where the festival is located, happening near Patrick Creek, you know, you're within 30 miles of 20 runs probably. And so hopefully people go find other places to paddle than the classic runs, because those might be too high. And there's tons of places to paddle on the Smith, so there's no lack of opportunities.
I do feel like everybody who spends much time paddling on the Smith has some story of getting their butt whooped. Yeah. Like every single person at some point gets a beating on the Smith or some fork of the Smith, it seems like.
Yeah. So I think what happens is people think that on the Smith, the places to paddle are the North Fork, Oregon Hole Gorge, and South Fork Gorge. I think that's what most people think about, and they're really fun when the water's good. But at high water and low water, there's just so many more places to go. It's an unlimited mecca for places to paddle. So hopefully people go down there and check out some other places too.
Yeah, cool. You know, a couple other pieces of news. If you're waiting for your Salmon River, Hell's Canyon, you know, your Idaho lotteries, came out yesterday. Those announcements are getting pushed back a couple weeks. I think somewhere towards the end of the month is when they're going to come out with the results on that lottery, just because the government shutdown kind of pushed things back. So just because you haven't heard doesn't mean you're not going to get something. That subway permit still may be coming your direction. It just might be a couple weeks later. So that's one of those things worth noting. And on that note,
actually, Eric, going back, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
So I think the Rogue is out. Like the Rogue lottery is out. I got a call this morning, somebody calling wanted to rent gear. And so I just told them to call Whitewater Cowboys, of course, down the road. But I think that does get announced.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the Rogue did come out. So we're starting to get rental calls pretty regularly now, so which is great. So, yeah, if you got a permit for the Rogue, I would suggest starting to get your equipment and stuff reserved soon. And then on the Idaho permit side, it's worth noting that we have been getting pounded with snow up here, and the salmon drainage is up in the high 90s now for snowpack, which is awesome. So Oahe drainage is looking epic, which is great. So Oahe, Bruno, all that kind of stuff this spring could be really, really good. And then the salmon for the summertime is looking awesome as of today. So what was some snowpack concerns up here in Idaho seem to be going away as we get continually pounded with snow.
Awesome news. Yeah, I think it looks like there's more snow in the forecast, so we may get past 100% here pretty quick.
Yeah, the skiing up here has been kind of all time lately. Yeah. So, for schools were canceled here in McCall for 3 days for the first time in anyone's memory, like in living memory. Wow. It was the first time that's ever happened because we had so much snow. We had, you know, wind drifts that were 6 feet tall across the highways and stuff. So
awesome.
It's been exciting. But anyway, you got any more news of the week, Zach? That's all I've got.
I got nothing. Aaron, you got anything?
Well, California's got good snow, too. I think they're like the Sierra is around 130, 140% of normal for this time. So cool. There should be some good boating coming this spring.
Yeah.
It's about time California had fun, too.
Right? Good year boating, I think, kind of all over the West, which is great. So staring down a fun season to be a boater. Great. Well, should we move on to our main topic for the day, which is becoming a river guide, how to do it, why to do it, what not to do, all those kinds of things.
So, yeah. And I think the topic I really want to do is like not just how to become one, but how to apply for a job as one, if you're experienced, you know, kind of like like if you're trying to apply to work for a company, Eric and I both run rafting outfits, and we get a lot of applications, like how to apply as a professional or how to get a job with a company. Like, does that sound good?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah.
Because I think that we're getting tons of applications right now, and some of them are really good and some of them really bad. And hopefully we can talk about, like, if you want to get a job, what it looks like. And I think, as I think about this, I think there's a couple types of companies. There's companies that are kind of small.
Wait, no, hold on, Zach. Are you going to stereotype companies like Priscilla stereotypes yes. people?
Yeah, but I'm going to try not to. I'm going to try not to. Oh, man. Yeah, thanks for saving me on that one. I think, yeah, that's funny. I think there's
companies... Priscilla stereotypes river guides. Sorry.
Yeah. Just river guides. No, I think there's rafting companies. I'm going to put myself in this category where we're a small company. We run a handful of multi-day trips. We only hire a few guides a year. And so it can be a little bit harder to get a job. And then there's a whole spectrum all the way to like rafting companies that have 200 guides doing day trips on class three, where they're just trying to hire 20, 30 guides a year. And it's generally fairly easy to get a job with them, but they might need more just experience right away, where I'm more willing to maybe train somebody if they're the right person. So I think there's a huge spectrum. Where do you put yourself in that category, Eric?
We are, I would say, smack dab in the middle. Okay. In that, you know, we do hire, you know, the 15 to 30 new people every year. But the same way, like, I'm much more interested in finding the right person and then training them to do the things that I need and to kind of work with us and for us than I am in hiring the skill set, like the hard skill set, and hoping the person works out.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. I'm the same way. So like sometimes people apply to us with a ton of experience and really important, really awesome resumes, but you know, maybe they're not a good fit for a company, so they may not get a job. And instead I hire like a 22-year-old who, you know, guided for one season and has done a bunch of private trips just because that 22-year-old fits what I'm looking for as a person more. So I have a list. I came up with six things I think that are important things to do when you're applying for a raft guide job. And I'll go down the list and you guys can comment on them if you want. And the first one is apply in a professional manner with complete sentences, correct spelling, and proper grammar.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you send me a resume, one, I want a resume and a cover letter. I want the resume, you know, a professional resume, and two, a cover letter kind of talking about why you want to work for us, like what it is about our company that you like, what it is about, you know, why you want to be a river guide, something about you personally, like giving you a sense of who you are and what you're looking for in a good, well-written cover letter. Again, yeah, with complete sentences, proper punctuation.
Capitalizing the first letter of a sentence.
Making sure that you have the correct word in a place, you know, like sometimes autocorrect will replace the word you intended with a different word. All of those kinds of things. Something that shows you invest, like you care enough about getting this job that you've invested in applying to it.
Yeah. Do you ever get things sent to you in a Word doc format where it automatically shows the words? It just shows you the words misspelled when you open it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like that's embarrassing to me. So like those, I almost always immediately just don't follow through with those people. That's just a dead giveaway for me. No matter how good somebody is, if they can't present themselves, it's kind of a turnoff for us.
I think the other thing I would say is, you know, I think, and this is probably true for any job you apply for, the way you talk and the way you write are different, mm-hmm. or they should be. And so if like your cover letter is written in a way that is extremely conversational, and I'm not a formal person, so like the Mr., you know, in my case, like Mr. Wyseth, like that's kind of the, I'm not concerned with you being incredibly formal, yeah. But it is important to me that you don't just write this like we're the best of friends having a casual conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that can be sort of a turnoff, yeah. Like making assumptions about, you know, like, hey, guys that are, hey, I'm just looking for, you know, fill in the trip here and there. I'm already working on the Middle Fork, but it'd be great to fill out my schedule a little bit and get a trip on the Main, or, you know, something that's very casual and very presumptive is kind of a turnoff.
Yeah. Well, you know, I look a lot at the how they introduce. Usually it's an email they send us because the information about getting a job for us isn't obvious on our website. Like, we have to send it. It's hidden. So they have to somebody has to email us or call us first. And a lot of times they'll just do hello, comma, which is okay. But if hello isn't capitalized, I'm just like, really? You didn't take the time to capitalize hello? Or, like, it'll say, you know, it'll have my name. Like, they did a little research and found out that Michael or I are the ones hiring, like Zach. So it might just say Zach, comma, or dear Zach. But if it says, like, hey, Zach, comma, that's a little too informal for a first introduction. You know, I never get Mr. Collier. Do you ever get Mr. Weiseth?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I never get that that I know of. But in that initial email, at least showing you know who you're talking to, or, like, dear hiring manager, at least. But, like, hello, comma, is a kind of a weak opening. And I put a lot of thought into I look really hard at that opening. And how much effort they put into it.
Wow. So they don't like put the right, if they say hi or good morning, comma, and then you're just like, nope, out. I'm not going to read anything.
good morning, comma, I kind of like, actually. It shows it. Like, yeah, kind of. It's true. Like,
yeah, you kind of sound like a jerk, man. I don't know if I'd want to work for you.
Well, you may not be able to get a job if you put hello, comma, and you don't capitalize hello. I mean, it's part of the whole package. You know,
oh,
like I look at that pretty closely because it said they put some time and effort and thought and care into it instead of just a quick like busting out an email, you know, over 45 seconds to apply for a job. Aaron, what would you do?
Well, to try to get a job, I mean, I think you guys hit on it. It's like, well, you got to figure out what the best way to reach out. Is that by email or by phone? And I think some of that's individual, like how comfortable you are on the phone versus how comfortable you are with email. And then you got to reach out. And then you guys hit on it, you know, like whenever I've applied for a job, I've always included like a cover letter, my resume, and then my river log. That's what I send. And I feel like that's between the three of those, that sends a good impression. The cover letter is really focused on the company that I'm applying to and why I want to work for that company. And then I may make some small adjustments to my resume, depending on the company I'm applying to, but minimal. And then the river log is just my river log. So, yeah, that's my approach. And then, you know, usually I even like to send like a hard copy in the mail sometimes, yeah. just to show a little more time, like, hey, I printed it out and then addressed it, found the address, addressed it, and sent it, and then send a hard copy and then follow up a week or two later with a phone call and just say, hey, I sent you some information and I'm just following up. And
I think that's one of the pieces that I would say is I used to feel like I saw more of and I see less of now, and I find it really unimpressive, is the lack of follow-up. You know, the like shooting an email after an interview. It's like, hey, it was great interview. You know, somebody's sending me one like, hey, you know, Eric, it was great interviewing you with you yesterday. I really enjoyed our conversation. I look forward to hearing back from you and I hope we get to go forward. You know, something really casual, but just a follow up saying something, I think shows a bit of drive that we see less and less of. You know, that used to be like almost everybody you'd interview, it seemed like, would send some sort of a follow-up. And now I feel like that's 1 out of 10. And it's impressive when you get it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a normal thing to follow up with a job. It shows that you care. And so, like, Aaron, the reason you've worked all over the world and kind of worked the best rivers there are is because you put that effort out. You know, you didn't just say hello, comma. And I mean, you're like, you did some research and wrote a cover letter. Another on that topic, like I really like when cover letters and resumes are PDFs. That's a detail I look at. When I'm on a Mac, so I open things up in Pages. And so when I open up a Word doc, it doesn't look like you intended it to look. And I don't want to see words underlined and things. Like,
It may not look like you intended it.
Yeah, a lot of times it doesn't. It changes. The formatting is different.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. A PDF is – you should be sending PDFs.
Yeah. And we don't give very many, but if I see a PDF, that's just a sign that like – of somebody I typically like. And also the letter thing is huge. There's a guy I hired maybe like 8 years ago, 10 years ago. He wrote the most beautiful letter on stationery that was incredibly thoughtful. I got that in the mail and it looked professional and good. I knew I was going to hire that guy. And he worked for us for like 7 years just from that initial, like he put care and thought into putting something in the mail to introduce himself and the way he did it. So when I'm looking for hiring, I'm looking less at like how many river miles you have. I barely look at the river log. I'm more looking at how somebody presents themselves through the process.
Zach, if you get an application and it's somebody who's guided on, you know, like they've guided all over mm-hmm. and they've guided for six different companies for a long time, that kind of thing. Is that something that appeals to you, or it's not a neutral, right? So is that a positive or a negative?
I'm going to answer that, but Aaron, I want you to answer this too, because I want to see what Aaron thinks after I say what I think.
That's tricky. It's tricky. Are you going first? Am I going first?
You can go first, because I'll follow up with – I already know my answer. You should go first.
It seems like you want to see people who commit to companies and aren't just like jumping from 1 year to the next, to a different company every year because you don't want to deal with – you know, like looking at you from your guys' perspective, like you don't want to hire someone new every year and you want someone who knows the system, who can help everyone else. And like you're more of an asset once you've been around a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a balance there, right? Having some experience working with different companies is good, because I feel like sometimes people who only work for one company, they can be a little challenging to work with because they think there's only one way to do it. Mm-hmm. And people work for a couple of different companies. And even if they just like work mainly for one company and rent a guy and some for another on the river, that's fine too. Just as long as they're flexible and have this ability to adjust to different scenes. So yeah,
that's pretty much my answer too. Like, if they've worked for a bunch of companies, it's great experience and super cool. But I worry, one, that I want to hire somebody for 4 or 5 years. I don't want to hire somebody for a year or two, that they're just going to work for us a year and move on. Or the reason they work for 4 or 5 companies is because they're difficult to work with and they can't find a home that matches them. And so I'm a little worried when they have a lot of experience. Or another thing too is, you know, there's things that are important to the way we run trips, and every company says this, and we're the same. Like, we're very guest centric, and I want guides that are guest centric. And I don't think throughout the industry, a lot of guides are super guest centric, maybe they think they are. And a great example to me is when you arrive in camp on a multi-day, a lot of guides feel like that within 15 minutes, they need to sit down and have a beer for half an hour. And like, I totally disagree with that. And so if I hire a guide who has a lot of experience, I worry that they're ingrained in them that they get to have a beer within 15 minutes of arriving to camp. I'd much rather them get to camp, walk around, check in our guests, help them get settled in, answer questions, set camp up, and then take some downtime. And so changing guides to kind of fit the way I feel like a well-run trip is done is much harder when they have a lot of experience, a lot of companies. And so in the interview, when I interview them, that's the thing I'm going to find ask is like, how willing are you to adapt to like the way we do things? To answer your question, Eric?
Yeah. I mean,
what's your answer?
I agree with kind of all of those things, right? Like for me, there are times when I've got a specific like skill set that I need. I need a gear boater for the main salmon, or I need a gear, you know, like it's usually around a gear boater. Like I need somebody that's going to row a heavy boat on this river. And so getting that resume that's got tons of experience is a real, like in that one case is a real positive.
Yep.
And they're kind of going to be on their own anyway. So like how they fit into the company culture or whatever else, like those are, I can sideline those a little bit. Because they bring the specific skill set that I need for whatever that season is. But as a general rule for me, I actually don't look at it as a positive if I see a resume where this person's hopped, you know, six companies in 8 years and moved all over the place. Like that person's going to have a harder time selling themselves to me because of the same things you've talked about. Like I want the person that's going to be with us for 5, 6, 8 years. It's generally easier to train people to do things the way that we want them versus untrain the ways, you know, that they've learned elsewhere. That's a great way to put it.
That's a really great way to put it, actually. Like, untrained people.
I do think there's, you know, we had I taught a swiftwater rescue class one time with some rescue swimmers from the Coast Guard. And they talked about how they get moved around from station to station every 2 years. And when at first when I was thinking about that, I was like, that sucks. You know, like you can't settle in anywhere, you all these things. But from an operational standpoint, they explained it. It's, you know, we all get trained to do our specific job and we all operate the same way across the world. Doesn't matter if you're in the Coast Guard, if you do this job, like everybody does it the same. And part of the reason they move people around every 2 years is when people work together for too long, there can be complacency. They can start doing things, you know, sort of their own unique way. And that eventually creates breakdowns in the overall system. It's better if you move people around, then everybody does things exactly the way they're supposed to because they, you know, aren't comfortable as comfortable with the people they're working with. And so it creates operational consistency. And there's some truth to that. I think when you bring in like new people with new ways of doing things, it keeps everybody a little sharper.
Yep.
You know, they're going to come in and say like, well, we did it this way at our place. And, you know, this may be an improvement on what you're doing. Like it challenges the system a little bit and gets rid of that complacency. When you have new people who've seen things done well elsewhere, it can be really good for your system. But it can also be really challenging too. So it's a mix of like when I hired those people, it's, hey, I appreciate that you're going to come in with lots of cool stuff. And I'm really excited to see that. But I also need you to know that we've been doing this for 49 years. We're pretty good at what we do. And there's going to be times when you have to say, oh, the way you do it is good. I see that. And I'm willing to go along with that. Like there's going to be a give and take on both sides for us where we can learn from each other.
Yeah. You were going to say something, Aaron. This is a hot topic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say like from the guy perspective, I feel like when you're new to a company, what you really need to do is you need to embrace the way they do it first. And like try to understand the whole big picture, because there's certain little things you're like, well, why are they doing like this? This is easier. But in terms of the big picture of the system, it's a different scene. And so kind of my comment always is like, hey, first understand how we do it and just like embrace it and like take and get into it. And then once you figured it out and can do it well, then we can talk about your ideas of how we can make it better, yeah. But not until they've grasped it. And usually I'd say like not until like the second season,
yeah.
Because like if that, you know, that, like you said, you've been doing it for a long time. And I just feel like people jump in too quick and want to change things and it just doesn't always work out that well, you know, and it causes a lot of stress for the people who've been there and it creates a lot of problems.
Yeah, if you've been there for a while, you don't want to have somebody come in. Like, you just have a system. You don't want somebody to come in and be like, do this. And they're like, oh, come on. Just, like, go along with it for a bit. And I tell people, wait a year before you make suggestions. Like, learn how we do things. And then once you know in a year, you can, like, make suggestions. But don't come in your first three trips or year even and say, hey, I think we should do the hand wash this way. Or, hey, why don't we, pack the coolers this way. Like, just learn how we do things. And then you can make them better after a year. For sure.
And then that all being said, like when that person is in the kitchen, they're cooking something though, don't micromanage them.
Yeah.
Give them space to you know, let them do it the way they've done it before. And then I see that on the other side of it though, is it's like this person's been guiding for 10 years. Like they probably know how to do a Dutch oven and like everyone's got their own way to do it. And just like, don't expect, oh, you gotta do it. It's like, okay, let them make their cake.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And if you mess up the cake, I mean, so what?
Yeah.
Like it's tough. Yeah. It's like, it sucks, but you know, let people make mistakes too.
Yeah.
Eric, you said one thing earlier that really rung with me, like about hiring the right person for a job. And so that's one thing that's big to me. And what's really hard is we have a really good applicant this year, a guy I really want to hire. Like I would love to add him to our company. He just doesn't fit a specific niche that we're looking for. And so one suggestion I have to people applying to companies is if you don't get a job, it's not because you're a bad guide. It's not because of reasons you might think. It just might mean that you don't fit a specific niche in the company. You know, for us, we've had more women guides than male guides for a few years. And we get more women applicants than male applicants. So we have been looking for men. for sure, but men have a specific skill set that fits a very, you know, a need that we have on the rivers we're doing. Like some years we need more experience. Some years we have a ton of experience and we actually need people who are willing to be followers. So, you know, in the people we hire this year, we have a very specific type of person we want to hire based on our needs. And that might be different next year. And for me, it's a bummer to like meet really cool people, interview them and go through the process and then not hire them only because it's not the right match for that year. And hopefully hopefully they keep applying the following years. Right? I try to stay in touch with them knowing that I might hire them in a year or two.
Yeah, I can see that. For us, I have less, that's less of an issue for me because I can probably find a place to put in a good person most of the time just because of, you know, the size that we have. It may not be exactly what the person wants for a year, but, you know, I can usually hide them in somewhere.
Eric, do people typically start with you guys on day trips or do you hire straight people straight to like the middle, the main salmon or the rogue?
I would say 90% of the time you're going to start out on day trips. Okay. You know, you're going to start out on the easy stuff and work your way in. With the building of our Idaho operation, you can shorten the time before you're going to move to the multi-day stuff with us if you're in our Idaho operation, just because I have less of, like, my bench is a little shallower up there than it, like in Oregon. I mean, hell, I'd been guiding for OTT for 6 years, was like the general manager, like managing the business before I ever got to run a rogue.
Because that's right.
I've got the bench that we have there where like the newest person on the bench has been around for 15 years.
Wow.
You know, like that's just the nature of the rogue for us for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, we've done a better job, I think, the last couple of years of bringing in some of our younger people and trying to get them a trip or two on the rogue in those first couple of years they work for us. But now we just got a really deep bench there. But you know, your first year or two, you may get a multi-day on the Klamath, or, you know, if you're in Idaho, you may get to go on a lower salmon or something like that. But it's very rare unless you come in again with that specific skill set. Like I interviewed a person this morning that's got, you know, a ton of, you know, not a ton, but a reasonable amount of experience. And she would likely be someone who's going to be at least 50% multi-day trips or more her first year.
Cool.
But she comes in with just some of that experience that prepares her for that. So,
well, I'm gonna plug in my list. I made a list, and we've been off topic for a while. I'm just gonna go over my list because I worked on it, of the things that I suggest people think about when applying for a job. So we've touched on some of these, but because I worked so hard on them, I want to say them out loud. Next is do a little research about the company you're applying for.
Yes,
you know, just a little bit. Like, hey, I see you do trips into, you know, here and here. I get a lot of applicants that, it looks like they're just cutting and pasting the exact same thing that starts with hello, comma. Like I have no idea if this is meant for me or it's an email that went to 20 different companies. And so just a little bit showing that you actually like want to work for us goes a long way with me.
I've probably had 2 or 3 cover letters this year where they actually attached the wrong one.
Yeah.
Like one that was written, you could tell, for a different company.
That's actually happened where either the email or the cover letter has a different company's name in it. Yeah. And so, and the fact that, I mean, I read them. So I email the person back and I'm like, oh, you actually want to, you know, I'll use your example, Eric, if they put Orange Torpedo, I'd be like, oh, you actually want to talk to Eric at Orange Torpedo. Here's his phone number. And then they always get back to me. No, I'm sorry. That was a mistake. And like, that's actually happened a few times.
Yeah. I have a set, you know, question list that I go through in our kind of initial interviews. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a couple of those questions are related to what do you know about Orange Torpedo trips? Why specifically have you applied for Orange Torpedo trips? What is it about us from your research or whatever that makes you want to work here?
Yeah.
And the conversations where it's like they obviously don't know anything about us or they haven't done any back, like have no sense of why they'd rather work for us than anybody else. That's, you know, not terrible. Like, it's not a deal killer, but it certainly is not as much of a slam dunk on the person as if they can be like, oh, well, I know this about you and I did my research and I really like this about your history. I like this about your culture. I like, you know, whatever it is. That, again, it just speaks to sort of their drive and motivation and desire to be employed.
Well, and it's going to be, I know it's going to be a good match. Like, if they know about us and they've applied for us because they like what we're doing, I just know it's a better, going to be a better match than if they're just trying to find a job. You know, like they're like, oh yeah, we're, I'm just trying to find a cool company to work for. Next one on my list is follow up with emails and or phone calls. We kind of touched on that. And I think one thing I want to pass on to anybody looking for to apply for a job is that, you know, a lot of times we get a lot of applications and, you know, we're busy doing other stuff. And sometimes we're really bad at getting back to people. And it's not because you're a bad person. It's just that, like, you know, we have life going on and we're irresponsible, which there's no excuse for that. But anybody who follows up, it's just like in our ear, like, oh yeah, I'm really sorry I haven't got back to you. And, we're trying really hard to get back to everybody promptly and professionally, but sometimes something gets missed. And so following up is huge.
I told a person this morning, I was like, you know, this time of year, there's really just two of us around and we're answering all the phones, booking trips, like dealing, you know, with federal permits and everything else, and things fall through the cracks. Yeah. So like, please harass me.
Yeah.
Like, feel free to call, email, like that will help your cause, because it's, you know, I don't like that happens, but, I'm going to call back a client before I call back you right now.
Yeah. Yep. That's what's hard. And Eric, you and I were in Southern Oregon last week. So for like 3 or 4 days, we were just gone to get back to people. And that's no excuse. Like we're, you know, we expect applicants to be professional, so we should be equally professional. But, you know that we're not perfect. And just because we don't call you back doesn't mean you're awesome. I guess that's my point.
Aaron, what would be your – because you're on the opposite – if you're on the opposite side of that, like how do you interpret that? Does that make sense?
I just look at it like, okay, let's say like 30 people applied to both your companies and you guys are busy and got other stuff going on. And just because – I don't really look at like you're supposed to respond back to me in any sort of time manner. Like you've got my information and – I figure you guys are looking at me saying, oh, he's probably applying to other places too, not just that one spot. Mm-hmm. So he's probably got other stuff going on. And if I don't follow up, that means maybe I got a job someplace else. You don't know. So I feel like, I guess for me too, is that I've always like selected companies I wanted to work for and then aggressively pursued those companies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I made clear and then I follow up. So I want to, like, I've been more selective on the companies I want to work for. And so that's kind of my angle. It's like, so I will follow up to make sure that they know that I'm really interested in, I'm not one of those people sending out 100 resumes.
There's people I've hired because of their follow-up. Like at some point it was like, all right, you're harassing me. And it's like, I probably wouldn't have offered you the job, but I will now. And they've actually, that a couple times they've turned out to be awesome. Like somebody I probably would have passed on based on the first round of talking to them, but because of their follow up, they sold me. So,
and somebody like Aaron, with somebody with the way you would present yourself and your experience, if you applied to work for us, like it would be my mistake not to be following up with you too. You know, if you're just like one of like 20 or 30 normal applications, things might get missed, but somebody who's really good and presents themselves well, I don't want to miss out on either. And so I work really hard to make sure we follow up with those people quickly. So how you present yourself is how you get followed up with, as well. Like, so anyway, to move on, the next thing is make time for phone, Skype, and or in-person interviews. People apply to us all the time and then we try to set up a time to talk and they're too busy traveling through Thailand or something. Or their ski patrol job, for whatever reason, is 24 hours a day, and they can't find time for a half an hour interview. And so know that, like, beyond the application, there may be several phone interviews and even a Skype interview down the road. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think yesterday I had one. It's like, hey, she emailed back. She's like, I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm really sorry. My class schedule is complicated. Yeah. Like, how about these five times? Can you do any of these times? These would work. And I, you know, we appreciate that people are busy, but to help us try and solve the problem.
Yeah. Next is we already talked about this, but you may not get the job this year, but that doesn't mean you're a bad guy or a bad fit. I just think that's so important. Like I said, there's people who I can't hire this year, but I would love to hire next year.
That sounds like you're just trying to let people down easy.
No, it's not. Well, I mean, It's not. I mean, it's hard for me because there's people who it's easy to just say, hey, I'm sorry, I don't have a job. But there's some people I really want to hire, and it kills me that I can't or I won't because they're not, like, fitting a thing I need that year. And it's only because we're small. We're not, like, a huge company, so we don't have, you know, a ton of spots. Unless you want to be a shuttle driver or a food packer. That's what we got.
Question for you, Zach. Yeah. And I appreciate that you have a bias here as someone who is offering one of these. If you see an application and says, like, I attended such and such guide school, mm-hmm. and, you know, I paid money for 6-day guide school, whatever, mm-hmm. is that, like, all of a sudden they move to the top of your list?
No, we don't offer guide schools. We do, like, rowing classes for private boaters. So we don't offer rowing.
Well, but you're offering a what's the
IRF thing. Yeah, so yeah. That's a little different. The IRF thing is more less of a school and more of, like, a test of your abilities. And so I've learned a lot more about the IRF class. That we talked to Mark Hurst about it.
Yeah.
He's the guy instructing it. And it's more of a testament to you know how to do basic things like flip a boat, give a safety talk. So it's more of a checking off that you're a competent guide. So, yeah, if somebody has an IRF thing, now that I know more about it, I'm like, oh, cool. They have, like, a basic skill set that not everybody has. So I've had applications this year where people say, hey, I'm an IRF level 3 guide. And a year ago, I would have been like, so? Like, I don't care. But now that I know more about it, I'm actually like, that's good to know. But it's not a major hiring decision for me, for sure. I do look at if they've gone to a guide school here in the U.S., I would look at the company. Like, some companies I know, like, are kind of, you know, maybe their guide school is a little sketchy. There are people who have gone to Arda. I know Arda does a good job doing guide schools, and Aaron's taught a bunch of them. If I know they've been to an artist school, I'll find out if Aaron taught that school. And if he did, I'm actually more likely to hire him, you know? So, or I'll call Arda maybe and say, hey, who taught this guide school? Or do you know about this student in the school? Cause I know people at Arda, just call and I can ask them about the applicants. So, going to a guide school, I think helps for sure, but I would delineate between good ones and bad ones and who taught them. But the IRF thing, yeah, it's cool. I like it. I would be more likely to hire somebody. Did that thing. So the number 6, my last talking point, which I'm pretty excited about, is volunteer to tag along a trip or two the year before you want the job. And, you know, if you want to work on one of the more prestigious rivers, like the Middle Fork or the Maine Salmon or the Rogue or whatever, sometimes it's harder to get a job with those companies. And, especially if it's a tight-knit crew, like a small crew of just like 5 guides and they hire one person a year. And a lot of times those are the most rewarding jobs because it's just a tight crew of people. And so if you want to get in with that tight crew, you know, just say, hey, let me tag along in August on a trip and get to know you guys and see if it's a good match. And we have a handful of people do that every year. And we typically hire those people for the following year. And so it's just a good – you have to think way ahead and you have to volunteer your time. But that's kind of how you break into, you know, the really small companies that are niche.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I would agree with that.
You know, like to get on a Middle Fork crew, most of the Middle Fork of the salmon outfitters, they just do the Middle Fork. You know, it's 5 or 6 guides that just do 8 or 10 trips a year, and they just do that. And to break into that crew, it's brutal. It's really hard. And so, especially if you have no experience on the Middle Fork, so you could, you know, go to them the year before and say, hey, I'd love to just tag along on a trip and help out. And that's the best way to get into the company like that.
It's a good opportunity to get a feel for the company too. Like, yeah, as a guide, you're going to get a feel for the crew, the experience. Is this something I really want to do?
Yep. Is this company professional? I think that's an equal question. Yeah. Is like, you know, when we interview people, I always tell them, I go, hey, I'm interviewing you, but please interview me as well. Like, I would hate for you to come show up on day one and think we're a bunch of bozos, right? Like, this is your opportunity to realize, like, if we're the right match for you as a person. And so, doing a trip is a good way to find out as a guide if it's a good company to work for. If they're professional, they're safe, you know, they kind of fit your ethics, that kind of thing. Your politics maybe might be important. So, that's my list. Any other thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that you hit on something really key at the end there, Zach. And I think the cultures vary so much company to company and river to river. And so, like what you said about like checking it out and checking out the scene beforehand and like trying to find the right match is really important. I think if you're just applying to every company under the sun, your odds are good that you'll find a job, but I don't know if it'll be as rewarding as one if you really look for someone look for a place where the culture is what you're looking for. And that to me is what I've really noticed over the years is like, you know, I see people who just end up in the right company and then they have a great time. And then when they're in the wrong company, it's awful. And, you know, you're living with these people all summer. And so you got to really find that right match.
Yep. Yep. And people show up on day one to work with you and you're like, oh no, this is going to be a weird fit.
Yeah.
Like at least in my experience, you can tell pretty quickly and you're almost always right. Like, you know that they're not going to make it through the season or this will be their only season. It's pretty uncanny.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. I think the company culture piece is a big deal on both sides of the equation. You know, you should do some homework and apply for companies that you think you'll fit in with, like their culture excites you because you'll both be happier and put on better trips and everything else. Like, it'll be a better experience for everyone if you've done some of that homework ahead of time.
Yep. I have one last question for you guys on this topic, and then we should probably move on to gear of the week if we have time. Mm-hmm. In an interview, when I'm interviewing somebody to be a guide, I'd say half, maybe 30%, 40% of the time, they ask me, how much does the job pay? Is that a good thing, a bad thing? I'm like, I don't really know how to take that. Is that a typical thing a person would ask me in an interview? Or is that weird? Or do I have a responsibility to be like, yeah, this is how much you pay exactly, and let them know?
Well, I mean, it seems kind of weird in some ways to want a job and have no idea how much you're going to get paid. Mm-hmm. Because you're like, yeah, you get paid $5 a day. You know, you know what I mean? Like if you don't have a connection to the company and know how much you'll get paid and have someone you talk to about it, then it seems in some ways to be an appropriate question is like, what's the compensation? Because like, you know, these people are trying to live off of this.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that seems like a reasonable question. That being said, a lot of times it comes with a job offer. So I think it depends on how you want to handle it.
Oh, so you do the interview, maybe that's not there. But then when you make the job offer, you say, hey, here's the pay rate, just so you know, before you say yes.
Yeah.
Like here. But but it's not like, also, if you ask an interview, it's a perfectly legitimate question, right?
I think so. Like, what's the compensation, you know, like, and what type of benefits are there?
Yeah.
You know, like certain companies will let you bring a friend every year on the river and you're like, whoa, that's really cool. And that that means a lot to me because whatever, I want to be able to bring my brother on the river, or, you know, whatever the case may be. It seems like every company's got their own little benefits that they have. And so I think that's an appropriate time, like if they haven't learned about it before, to understand what are the benefits of working for the company. And part of that, you know, is your compensation. It's like, what are you getting paid? What's the living situation? All those different benefits.
Cool.
I would agree with that. It's a totally appropriate question. And in some ways, there's a sense of maturity that comes with that of recognizing that this is an important question. And also different places in life. Like, I tend to get that question more from folks that are a little further down their guiding path than, you know, the college freshman who's looking for the day trip job.
Yeah.
So it kind of depends on where you are, I think, in your guiding career, the likelihood that you're going to ask that and everything else. And also how I'm going to take it too. Like that freshman, you know, the kid who's the summer college, like looking for the day trip job. I'm going to probably read into that different than I am the guy who's, you know, I'm going to hire him and he's going to head straight up to the Maine salmon and do nothing but Maine salmon trips because he's got tons of experience. Like it's a different conversation because that person's in a different place in life.
Yeah.
But no, I think that's an appropriate question that shows that, you know, you are looking at your life kind of holistically and you don't just sort of ride along on whatever's happens. Yeah. I think there's some positives to that.
Cool. Yeah. When people ask me, I'm always like, oh, they're just like, I get a weird sense. It kind of weirds me out and I know that's wrong of me to think. So it's good to hear you guys say that. I just need to, like, for some reason, like, it makes me think they're only in it for the money, But I also need to recognize that they should be. Like, it's a job, and they should be paid fairly, and they should know what that pay is. And so I need to get over that.
My hope is that by the time I get to that conversation, you know, one of the questions that I ask in our interview is, what's more important to you, salary or challenge? And so we have a conversation around that, hopefully, you know, in a less specific context before we get to that point where they've asked, like, well, okay, well, what is the compensation here? So we've already talked about sort of motivations and what motivates you and how we reward you if you do really good, which also is a conversation around money that we've already had before we even had this conversation.
Smart. I like that. Smart.
I mean, there's wide variations between companies on pay too. Like, it's unbelievable how much different you could be launching with the same company on a river every week, and the guides are getting paid, you know, like one company's paying 50% more than the other company. Like, there is some extreme differences in pay sometimes. So that's the other thing. It seems like it's a reasonable question to ask, just to get a ballpark. It's not an exact figure, but an idea of like, oh, is this one of those companies that pays nothing and says, oh, hey, you're a river guide, so you're really happy to be here, or one that's like, hey, we're going to be socially responsible and we're going to pay a livable wage for you.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to Gear of the Week. Do you guys have Gear of the Week?
You bet.
Let's hear it, Aaron.
Lucy Lights.
Oh, classic.
Yeah. Has that made it yet to Gear of the Week out here?
I don't think so.
Those things are amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, now they even have a little plug in them so you can, like, recharge your phone off of the solar panel.
Do you want to explain what they are for people that don't know?
Yeah, Lucy Lights are these little inflatable lights that you blow up, and they've got a little solar panel on one side, and they've got LED lights, and the lights last forever, and they're really bright, and they're great around camp, and they're really inexpensive. I think they cost like $10, $15 for one, or something like that. They're light. It's a fantastic piece of equipment. It's great for fall trips when it's getting dark earlier. Throw those out.
Speaking of lighting up camp, Eric and I learned about a really interesting way to use a propane blaster to light up camp, which we'll have to tell you about later. You'll appreciate this one, Aaron, but we probably shouldn't publicize it. Somebody you know explained it to us the other day. Lucy Lights are cool. My Gear of the Week is an American Whitewater membership. We had Wild Rivers Night in Portland this week, and one of my good paddling buddies I paddle with all the time told me he was not an American Whitewater member. I walked him over the table, and he had been a member in 2001, it turns out, but he signed up right away. And I think a lot of people aren't members just because it takes time to do it. It's an inconvenience. But I think it's like $35 a year. American Whitewater is doing great work. They need you as a member more than they need the money, probably. So please, paddlers out there, sign up there. It's worthwhile. Take a few minutes to do it. So that's my Gear of the Week. Eric?
I don't have any Gear of the Week this week.
Cool.
I just am behind on that, unfortunately.
That's fine.
But I do think the Lucy Light thing is those were a profound invention for, you know, our industry. Like, it's amazing, you know, thinking back 10 years ago, like the struggles of lighting camp up, or what you did to light camp up, or if you had things out, just how easy those are to now. It's like, oh, I'm going to walk out on, you know, like you said, spring or fall trips when it's dark earlier. Like, I'm just going to quickly walk out and set one of these in front of everybody's tent so they can find their tent at night. Or I'm going to set one, you know, at the start of the path for out to the toilet, and not worry about it. Don't worry about batteries going dead. Don't worry about whatever. Like, it just makes life so easy. Those are, for such a cheap thing, like such a profound tool. I think those are really cool. That was a good one. Good Gear of the Week.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Cool.
And get rid of batteries. Like, you're not dealing with batteries all the damn time. Like, So solid Gear of the Week. Cool. Well, that is all I've got. Unless you guys have any closing thoughts.
Nope.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thanks for hanging out and listening. Hopefully you're headed down, or I guess by the time you listen to this, well, maybe you're headed down because Zach gets them quick. Headed down to the Smith, or on your way back from the Smith, and you had a good time down there, or paddling somewhere with all the water that we've got coming out. Start looking for your permits for Idaho, or hopefully if you got a Rogue one, you're getting set for planning that for the summer and fun river trips elsewhere. Tell your friends about us. Rate us on whatever you listen to us on, good or bad, I guess. Let us know what you think. And get out and go on the river. But see you next week. I'm on Chattahoochee on the Rio Grande, the Allegheny and the Cumberland, on the river. Oh, this river's running fine. Gonna float me down that